You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where our owls don't deliver magical messages, they fight to the death. Today we discuss the forgotten Zack Snyder movie, Legend of the Guardians, The Owls of Ga'Hoole. I have no idea if I pronounced that right, it sounds like something out of Stargate, but I'm just going with it. Released in 2010, the film is Snyder's animated debut and earned $140 million worldwide on a budget of $80 million. There's no word of any sequels yet, but the movie was based on a series of children's novels by Catherine Lasky, so the possibility of more to come always exists. Do we want to see another? Find out in the latest edition of The Snyder Series. Joining me for this episode, via Skype, from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards. How are you, Daniel?
I'm doing well. This is going to be a good one. I can feel it in my gizzard.
Oh, God. Really? Already?
Yeah, already.
Also this joining
is the,
us.
Yeah, this is the most gizzardy thing Zack Snyder has ever done.
It is definitely the most gizzardy thing, and there are implications of that we may want to discuss at one point or another. So hold on to that thought. I think that's a really important thing. Also joining us via Skype from the House of Mouse, Elliot Rivera. How are you, Elliot?
I'm trying to remember if Metal Beak was a band from like the 80s or something.
If it wasn't, it would be if this movie had been released prior to the 80s, right? That's like the perfect metal hairband name.
Yeah. Metal Beak on
perfect
tour.
Perfect nerdcore metal band.
That's true. If Zack Snyder was cool among the nerds. I thought you were actually going to say that you were going to ask which character Metal Beak was, because to me this is like Game of Thrones for owls. There are too many characters. I don't know all their names.
It's true. Lots of names, lots of weird names. Metalbeak, Boron, Eggleteen.
Boromir is in this movie? Is that what I just heard?
Yes. No, Boron, like the element, like the atomic element.
Oh, I thought it was just because it was boring at points.
Oh. Well, we'll get into that.
All right, so let's start out where we should start with any discussion of any sort of story or film, with the theme. What did you guys think the theme of Legend of the Guardians is?
Owls kick ass.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's it. Owls kick ass. There wasn't any more, any deeper meaning to this. This is just Zack Snyder's Michael Bay movie.
I mean, this suffers from what many animated movies suffer from nowadays. And I think this is because it's based on children's literature, which is that there are competing themes, and I don't think they necessarily integrate into one overall theme. So there are many different competing themes in this movie, including like what it means to be good versus powerful, reason versus emotion or intuition, the relationship between yourself and your family. All competing themes. Do you think there's anything in common with them? Other than, you know, owls?
You turned that on me. I had a question for you. We'll return to my question for you in a second, though. But, I mean, I didn't really see much in common until you get to the very end. And it's sort of like the whole purpose is to protect people. And that was my biggest question about this movie is, I kind of think Snyder took this movie and worked on it because of, as we saw in the past, his love for the story Jonathan Livingston Seagull, where, mm-hmm. you know, that has sort of an undercurrent of religion and a discussion of the Jesus myth. And there seems to be a similar thing in this.
Yeah.
Where this seems to be very faith-based, right? We have the young character, his name's Sauron, I believe.
Sauron, yeah.
Yeah, he's the protagonist, and it's all about him having faith in the Guardians. And then at the end, they say, you know, the point of the Guardians is to protect the people who can't be protected and to help make the weak strong. So it seems to have a subtle Christian bent to it, or am I just being paranoid?
No, I agree with you. I mean, that's what I picked up on. I mean, I thought it was very, I was surprised because Snyder usually champions reason over faith. But this was a very pro-faith movie. When he talked about the gizzards, you know, don't, you know, when he tells Soren, you, when you chose between your head and your gizzard, you chose the head and that was where you failed. I mean, it kind of took me back a little bit. This didn't feel like a Snyder movie in a way.
Well, remember that he didn't write it. That's important. He hasn't written any of his movies so far in our series.
Right. I was going to say he wrote Sucker Punch.
Yeah. Here's an alternative reading. I feel like I'm being a social justice warrior.
Yeah, right now. I think you're being postmodern right now.
And mm-hmm. applying my own philosophy to it.
Right.
But
no, that's the interesting thing. Just to hold on for you for a second, just to interrupt you a little bit. But that's the interesting thing even about the story Jonathan Livingston Siegel, right? Have you guys read that story?
I've read bits of it after Snyder said he was interested and then I was radically bored out of my mind.
Right. So I read the whole thing and I was pretty much bored out of my mind as well. But I read the whole thing because it's short and I wanted to see how it influenced Snyder. But if you read it, it's basically in three parts. And it's about this bird who is going outside what the community tells him to do and learning how to fly. And then it becomes this whole thing where he's sort of like a Jesus-like figure where other people learn to fly too because he's flown faster than any bird has ever flown before, any seagull has ever flown before. And he sort of creates his own community. So it's this whole sort of weird Jesus thing where it's about like going against religion and the common thing and believing in man and, you know, believing in yourself. And but then it's also about believing in your abilities because it's all about he wants to be the ultimate seagull, and the ultimate seagull is defined by how fast he can fly and how well he can fly. So even though it's this weird Jesus thing, it's also about ability and how much ability you have and maximizing it. So that also seems to be a tension in what we know about Snyder, because he comes from a more religious, faith-based upbringing, right? He went to the, what kind of school was that? Christian Science School?
Yeah. And I definitely think there's something mystical about a lot of what he does, and he's talked about the human spirit before in a lot of interviews. So this is my quasi-alternative reading, and it goes to basically what you just said about trusting yourself and your abilities, which is, I didn't pick up a lot of faith in this movie or religion stuff per se. I picked up a little bit of mysticism, but the mysticism was couched in this notion of trusting your intuition, basically. They call it your gizzard. I guess in human terms we'd call it trusting your gut. Now, I've learned over years of having objectivists beat it into me that they're, you know, trusting your emotions emotions are not cognition, right? But there is something to be said about when you learn something and you do it over and over again, to not overthink it in a given moment if you've trained and learned something.
Right, and the best example
of that, trust your intuition.
Right. I mean, the best example of that is, Drew, did you get a time on this? Malcolm Butler in the Super Bowl, correct?
Yes. Yes.
Do I need to explain that for our listeners?
The best example.
Well, of course it's the best example.
You mean the best example that comes to Justin's mind every time.
It's the best example because I'm wearing my Malcolm Butler t-shirt right now. No, that he didn't think about it. He saw and identified and then just made the play. Because they had practiced it so many times. So you're saying that basically it wasn't faith. He wasn't having faith in Bill Belichick. Bill Belichick wasn't the guardian, one of the guardians. He just trusted his gizzard is what you're saying to make that game-winning interception.
Yeah, because there's a difference to me in like if the owl had said like, trust in the spirit of the wind to guide your wings, which is something external, right? Versus trust in your gizzard, which is something internal. And only after we had seen this owl show a little bit of natural inclination to fly when he was with his family, then learn to fly with the cool trader owl, and then take advanced tactical flying lessons with the crazy cuckoo owl.
Who's my favorite character of the whole thing.
Yeah, he's awesome. Okay. He's fucking badass. But so my point is that in this movie, it wasn't as if he was like, no flying, and then trust this magical thing and then flying. It was he learned how to fly better and better throughout this movie, and eventually the guy said, what's really fucking you up is you're overthinking this. Just do it. Just trust yourself and do it.
Well, I'll sidestep the discussion of overthinking, because I do think there's something there with, you know, if you don't know how to do something, there's no such thing as overthinking, but if you do know, I understand what you're saying, so I don't want to get into that debate. But I will say this to sort of foreshadow something that's coming later on. Your appreciation for a different movie makes a little bit more sense now when you portray Gizzard that way, and you portray it as an ability and not a faith-based thing.
Don't say Star Wars.
We'll get there later. Spoilers.
You prick.
Let's put the talons away, guys.
Ah, I see what you did there.
Hey, why don't we, before we go on, give like the 2-minute summary of what actually happens in the movie for anyone who hasn't seen it. But if you haven't seen it, I don't know why you're listening to this podcast. You should be hitting pause and actually watching the movie so you understand what the hell's going on.
Right. I think that is one of the understandings about this Snyder series is we want you to watch the movies before you engage in this discussion with us. For that reason, I think this episode will probably be pretty low rated, because I think we're one of the few adults who actually watch this movie. But my 2-minute synopsis is, I would say there's two brothers living in a tree. They're young owls. They're on the verge of leaving the nest. And one day they get in a fight and it causes them to fall out of the nest. They're kidnapped by the evil Nazi owls. One brother gets sucked into the Nazi society. The other one flies away, and when he flies away, he's told to find the Guardians. He finds the Guardians. He learns to train with the Guardians. The Guardians go into a trap at the Nazi stronghold. He's the one who eventually saves them all. And then they all come back and they defeat the Nazis, and he finds out that he is, too, a Guardian. The end.
That's pretty good. So in this movie, are the Guardians America? Where they're like, yeah, we'll wait until you completely rape and pillage basically the entirety of the world, and then we'll show up.
Well, that's the interesting thing about this movie and the undercurrents, is one of the things that we saw with the critiques of Zack Snyder, and we even saw a comment about this on the old Talkbacker site we were on, when people were responding to our Snyder things very vehemently. Somebody called Snyder a Nazi-based filmmaker, right? A Nazi propagandist. That was the insinuation. They linked him to one of those. But this movie very much is anti-Nazi and very much is America versus Nazism, isn't it?
Yeah, it's broadly speaking sort of freedom versus control, I would say.
Yeah, but I mean, with the Nazi thing, the evil owls are called the pure ones. I mean, you can't get much more of a Nazi metaphor than that, can you?
It's true.
There was the master race of owls. That's what they were doing. I mean, it was pretty thinly veiled.
And the leader was a great orator. A great orator.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. No, I think it's definitely in there. One of the more interesting elements of this, and it might go to a little bit more of the mysticism argument that Elliot is making, so I'm defeating my own case, is the trinkets, which play a very interesting role in this film, which is... They're having these moon-blinked or zombified owls pick out little metal trinkets out of rat carcasses. So that's a delightful children's story.
Right, out of the pellets owls spit up after they've eaten a rat carcass.
Yeah.
Which was one of the first real jarring things for me in this movie, in the beginning where they show the little girl owl, the little sister, just cough up that pellet. I was like, well, this was like a endearing kids movie until that kind of gross moment. And then it didn't make sense until they kidnapped the brothers and forced one of them to pick through the pellets. And I was like, okay, that's why they did that, for foreshadowing. But that was one of the few, I mean, this movie's a kids movie, but it's very sort of dark and breaks a kids movie's tone a lot.
Especially when the red streaks that you see like on Helen Mirren's character. And eventually you realize that, oh, that's blood. Interesting. So it's interesting to see blood that way.
So what do you see these specs as, Daniel?
Well, that's the thing, is when I was watching it for the first time, so this is the second time I've seen this movie, I saw it in theaters. That's right. I saw it in theaters.
Really? You actually saw this movie in theaters?
I absolutely did. It's animated and Zack Snyder. Of course I did. Who do you think I am? Okay. So when in the first time I saw it, I was thinking, oh, these are going to be like some sort of really powerful magnets, and they're going to hold down the Guardians who are wearing these heavily weighted metal whatever, and that's how they're going to trap them.
Well, it has to do with the gizzards, though, doesn't it? Because the reason the bats could fly in there is because they didn't have gizzards?
Yes, exactly. That's what I thought the first time. They were going to be magnets. But it turned out that they were something that messes with the gizzards of owls. And so I think that is, if you're going to make a stronger argument for mysticism, I think that plays into it. Even though that's a material thing, it has to do with this essence, this looking inside yourself. So it brings that down, man.
I just don't understand. Like they make a big deal about finding these metal flecks, but then they don't explain what they're doing with them. They don't explain what they are, and why. Because obviously Soren, he achieves victory. He defeats, you know, he defeats Metal Beak.
Victory.
Yeah, I mean he rescues the Guardians, but then you don't understand how he did it. You don't understand what exactly what was the threat. I mean, this blue light that's coming out of the metal affecting their gizzards. Like, what is that? How do you explain? That doesn't make sense. Like, what was that?
Doctor Manhattan's power. Obviously, it was all a plan by Ozymandias. Metal Beak is Ozymandias. You didn't pick that up?
Probably. But I mean, and the other thing, like the moon blinking stuff. Like, I mean, it's such a big deal when they present it, and it's hopeless. And then the little sister gets moon blinked, and then. Just by talking to her, she snaps out of it, and they never explain, like, how did that happen? Why isn't this happened before? Like, there's just some weirdness here. And I don't know, for me, it robs the ending a little bit, you know, because you don't really fully understand what exactly the threat was that they're going after.
I think that's partially the confused nature of the children's book. And partially.
Well, did you read the children's book too?
No.
Okay, I was going to say, did you do all the proper prep? Because I didn't read the children's book, which is probably a mistake on our part.
So, I don't care. It's about owls. No, I just think in general, children's books don't think these things through as much as they should. They just take them as a premise or as just for granted.
Well, but the other element of it is, just to interrupt you for a second, while we're talking about animated movies about Guardians that adapt children's books and you're talking about depth, I have to name check Rise of the Guardians, which I always get this confused with name-wise.
Yeah.
You know, the one about, you know, the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy and the Sandman. That was based on source material that was clearly very well thought through and does address all these things.
Yeah, that's one of the best animated movies ever and gets no recognition as such. Real travesty in the animation world.
That's why I wanted to address it.
The other point I was going to make is that this is, as we mentioned, the first book in a series. So it is plausible that the owls go forth and investigate this Fleck stuff further and you learn more about the mythology of their world. But also, like, don't be too hard on them. They're fucking owls. How much do you think they know? Think they've developed owl science?
Owl science, I like that.
I mean, I think though this whole blue light, and I'm going to come down in the middle of you two, which I guess is my role in this episode, because I think Snyder balances these things more than, you know, we care to admit. But I think the whole blue light messing with the gizzard sort of reveals Snyder's sort of maybe confused view of reason a little bit, because you know, while the gizzard is shown as sort of more faith-based or intuition-based, it's sort of like an offshoot of reason in that way. And what I mean is, reason is man's method of survival, correct?
Yeah.
Well, isn't the gizzard the owl's method of survival?
Oh, so isn't that just playing the biological card on us.
Isn't that the way it's established in the movie, that that's sort of how they fly? So if you get rid of the gizzard, they can't fly anymore?
I don't know about established, but yeah, it's referred to in that sense.
Well, that's how I'm saying it's established, that it showed we were attacking their gizzard. When their gizzard's attacked, they can't fly anymore. The only logical conclusion I can make then is that the gizzard is what makes them fly. So I don't know if it's necessarily anti-reason, even though it seems very anti-reason with the way he said you trusted your head, not your gizzard. But if we take Daniel's intuition argument and we cross it with this Fleck scene where all the the Guardians fly into this trap and the fleck and the blue light attacks them, doesn't that make it, you know, they're attacking the owl's means of survival? The essential of what the owl is?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think to defend Elliot a bit, there is a confused nature about this movie. So I don't think I could definitively say one way or the other. I think that's a good argument. I think it's based on the evidence that's in the movie, but it's not entirely in the movie, I think.
Well, here's the question then. Do you think the confused nature is Snyder or the movie?
The movie.
I think it's the story. I'm not sure it's Snyder. I think Snyder probably did with this what he did with Watchmen. Maybe not as extreme, but
oh yeah, he
tried to make sense out of something mystical.
Right, you can see the changes he made, right?
Yeah.
And now let's talk about one further thing about the theme that I think really needs to be discussed here, because I think, I don't know if this is a reflection of Snyder's influence or if this is in the original book, but I think when you're discussing this movie, you have to talk about the relationship between the brothers. Because this was used to frame the whole thing, and then to Elliot's point that the ending kind of peters out, the one brother kind of disappears, right? He falls into the fire, sort of like in a reverse Mufasa death, where this time the good guy's holding on and he can't hold on, and the brother falls into the fire, which Scar let Mufasa down. So he kind of just disappears, which I think is supposed to be the setup for the sequel. I'm assuming he, you know, sort of like in Kick-Ass 2, you can tell at the end that the motherfucker played by McLovin is going to become the villain. I feel like that was sort of the same setup for the sequel, so I think that's why they left that plot thread dangling, which that's the problem with writing for a sequel. It makes it so your story that you're writing now is open-ended and not as good as it could be. But I do think it's important to note that the relationship between these two brothers is very contentious, and that's what sparks everything, right? The competition between them. And I would say it's unhealthy competition. What would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the beginning, when they're learning to fly with their families, Sauron is sort of naturally gifted, and his brother, whose name completely escapes me at the moment,
Clud.
I can't find.
Clud.
Oh, yeah, him.
Klaatu.
Not...
I kept thinking of Klaatu.
Klaatu Baratheon, Nick, too. He's not talented, and so the tension arises.
Well, he's not as talented. I want to be clear about that.
He's pretty fucking clumsy in the beginning. Almost dies several times.
But, Eli's not as quote-unquote talented as Peyton, but he's won 2 Super Bowls. I'm just saying.
This is not comparable.
I don't think it's so much. I don't think it's so much that about the competition. I think it's more that Soren has a certain amount of courage, where Clud is a little more cowardly. I mean, even in that first scene when that beast, what was it, that panther or whatever, you know, comes out of the bushes to attack them, what does Clud do? He hides. He runs and he hides. He doesn't help his brother. And then that's when the other owls snatch them away. But, I mean, so, and you see this there when he refuses to acknowledge that Soren's his brother because he's afraid of Helen Mirren's character. I can't remember her name. Nypha or something like that. I think it's more the coward aspect that translates him into, you know, oh, this is how I cannot be a coward anymore, by being a pure one, by learning how to fight, by being a cheater. Like when they were chasing that blue little bird, you know, that little competition that she had. I think that's
when they were trying to catch the snitch.
Was it the snitch?
Let's make a Harry
Potter joke. A little golden ball. But yeah. I think that's I think more of it. Genuine courage versus arrogance that's rooted actually in cowardice and insecurity.
Right, insecurity, and that's the big thing when we're talking about the relationship between the two brothers. Clud is insecure because he's always comparing himself to Soren, and there's a little bit of, and Daniel, this is your purview, so I'm going to toss it to you, but this is a little bit of hatred of the good, isn't it?
Oh, it's absolutely hatred of the good. Clud is completely envious of his brother's talent. He thinks his brother doesn't deserve it, and he, Clud, does. And so it's not, so it progresses with just being this quote-unquote sibling rivalry in the beginning to him actually trying to kill his brother later on because he believes his brother, the things that make him good make him inferior to him spiritually.
Would you say there's a similar relationship between Metalbeak and the guy who is the old leader of the Guardians?
Oh, I see what you're doing there. Yes, I absolutely think that. It makes clear that a lot of what Metalbeak is doing is out of envy, and he wants to seek revenge for having been defeated by this lesser creature, this old, hideous owl.
Right, and that goes, you know, visually, that goes with the way they portray these people, right? Where the Guardian looks really ugly, but Metalbeak has this, you know, really definitive sort of cool look to him, especially with the mask he wears, right?
Yeah.
But the mask.
Hooter.
You're right. The mask, though, is a metaphor, right? For him covering up what he really is underneath.
The mask is always a metaphor.
And, you know, Pure Ones goes to show they want to believe they're the Pure Ones and they want to believe the Master Race, so they have to try and prove it by dominating everyone. They're not doing it because they're actually trying to achieve something.
Right. They're destroyers. The other owls, the Gahulians, have a tree where they build shit and learn shit and try to become better human beings shaped as owls.
Right, so I think that's all important to note because, you know, we've been very harsh on this movie so far, talking about the whole faith-based, emotion-based, intuition-based thing. But if you look at the whole other side of it with the metaphor of the Guardians versus the Pure Ones, and especially couched in the relationship of the brothers with looking at it from hatred of the good for being the good, then I think you see this whole other side of it that complicates it. And I think, Daniel, that's why you were saying the theme's all over the map, and you can't just concretize it one way.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so let's move on then to something that makes it a little more interesting for us because we're specifically looking at this in light of a Zack Snyder film, and we've sort of done that thematically in his ideas already. But let's discuss that with his style. Did you guys notice any specific stylistic elements that are very Snyder in this movie?
Oh, yeah.
You mean the whole movie?
Well, not the whole movie, but a lot of it, yes.
Okay, the whole movie minus the credits?
Yeah, minus the credits and minus the gizzard stuff, but.
Yeah. There's a ton of stuff in here. Of course, the fight scenes, which are just beautifully shot, with mixing slow motion with fast motion and getting the close-ups of the talons, like, barely missing the guy's eye.
Yeah, when you say that, the close-up of the talons, the image that sticks out to me is Snyder in this movie is when the Guardians attack the Pure Ones and the talons hit each other and they scrape against each other in slow motion.
Oh, yeah.
You hear that sound and you just watch it. Like, to me, that is Snyder through and through. And that's what I think of when I think of this movie, is that one shot.
Yeah, absolutely. The other element is, of course, deep color saturation. Everything has this sort of specific color tone for a given scene. The bad guys are a deep brown, like everything is rich and brown, and the good guys have this green and blue, sort of really fresh color tone. Of course, everything looks like a painting, not just because it's an animated movie, but because it's Snyder. Sort of like 300, where each scene, the brights are brought out and the darks are brought down, so that it's extremes in color and light. That's very Snyder-esque.
Elliot, what did you notice?
I love the what I call the whooshing. You know, the slow-mo when it pulls in, shows you something, and then it pulls out. And I mean, it's what I look for. I love it when I saw it in 300. Loved it when I saw it in Watchmen. I love seeing it here. It's probably just my favorite thing.
The whooshing. The Snyder whoosh.
Snyder whoosh. That's
I just love how he describes the Snyder whoosh as going in, showing you something, and then pulling out.
Oh, yeah. It's whoosh. It whooshes. And then it speeds up, and then it goes to something else, and whoosh. Somewhere.
I'm just picturing Elliot one day just being like, whoosh, whoosh me, whoosh me.
Yeah, that's dirty.
A couple things I noticed.
It's a whoosh. It's a Snyder whoosh.
Don't scream that during orgasm.
Oh my god, that would give you the crown of biggest Snyder nerd ever.
Snyder whoosh.
Yeah, take that, Bible of Zack Snyder. We coined the Snyder whoosh.
Snyder whoosh.
I'm just kidding. I like you, Bible, Zack Snyder. You also love Zack Snyder. Something else, a couple other things I noticed. The musical montage set to Owl City. Now, I know that, you know, he probably was obligated to put that in there because, you know, they did the official theme song of it, and I'm sure some marketing genius was like, let's get Owl City to do the theme song for the Owl movie. But just the way it was integrated is very Snyder-esque, using contemporary music in a thing that should break the tone of this entire movie, because that song doesn't really fit the movie, right?
Not at all, actually. And I actually think it did break the tone of the movie. I think Snyder did his best to integrate it. It was softer than it probably would normally have been, and the way the scenes were shot really fit the music. But I think overall, you're right, some marketing guy fucked up.
Right, it told Snyder to put it in, but then you saw, like you said, his talent, and because he started as a music video director, how he was able to match the music to the movie.
Yeah, I think it was in my mind, it was a nice vignette that was sort of separate from the movie. I mean, it integrated the story, but for me, it was like, oh, now it's time for the Owl movie song. Oh, now we're going to get back to the movie. And I don't blame Snyder for that, really. I mean, if we learn later that he personally made this choice, then I blame him, and this is his worst directing choice ever.
But I don't think he made the choice. I don't think Snyder was like, oh, let's use Owl City to be in the Owl movie. That'd be cool. That's some, like, you know, that's some, like, executive who's like, oh, yeah, the kids are into Owl City. Oh, this is an Owl movie.
Well, I mean, it is, but like you said, it is a kids movie, so they probably wanted something that would soften it a little bit for the kiddies, you know, so a musical montage is a good way to do that.
Well, right, but that's a typical marketing technique for animated movies. Daniel, correct me if I'm wrong, animated movie expert, but they always have some pop artist who has a song. I mean, even in the Lego movie, there was a version of Everything is Awesome by The Lonely Island featuring Tegan and Sarah. So this is pretty conventional, isn't it?
It's fairly conventional. I just think in this instance, the tone wasn't quite nailed.
Well, no, it wasn't nailed, and that's my point, is they were trying to do something conventional, and they had a non-conventional director. So it doesn't really make much sense that they did that.
Yeah, you're going to have everything that's beautifully stylized and completely non-naturalistic. Then you're going to have a song that literally talks about flying and by a group called Owl City. Like, it's almost like, how fucking naturalistic can we make the music choice? I mean, it'd only be better if they had a song called This Is a Movie Called Legends of the Guardians.
Just a side note, I never understood the Owl City thing. They seem like they're pure auto-tune to me. Was that my ears deceiving me, or?
No, you're right. It's like an auto-tune guy making fun of country music.
Yeah.
That's how I think of it.
But it's popular.
I barely remember anything of Owl City, so.
Making fun of guys by over-exaggerating the vowels. Take to the sky. Really? Really? That's how you're going to sing that?
Yeah, and they got this because they had one really popular song around the time this movie came out. So it was like marketing synergy, right? I'm sure that word was used.
That's how it was sold.
And then
another PowerPoint with that one word on it.
Let's be honest, so we compare all musical montages to the Hallelujah number in Watchmen.
I love that you say that over and over again, Elliot, because the number of people who hate that montage is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Am I wrong, though? Like,
no, you're objectively correct, but it's just funny that one of the reasons I enjoy the Snyder series is it so flies in the face of what the conventional opinion is. There's a list out there, and this is a side note about Snyder, but it's a Snyder series, so it's okay. But there's a list out there, if you read, it's like the worst directing decisions Zack Snyder has ever made. And one of them on the list is the Hallelujah montage in Watchmen.
I think that's a terrible list.
Well, of course it's a terrible list. But returning to things that are conventional in Snyder's style, something else I noticed on my second watch, because like you, Daniel, this was the second time I've seen this movie, is the way Soren kills Metalbeak. I had never noticed it before, but Soren's like this really, I mean, not Soren, Metalbeak's this really powerful villain, right? So how's this little young owl gonna kill him? Well, he kills him the exact same way young Leonidas kills the wolf in 300. Now, I don't mean he catches him in a bottleneck, What I mean is the Metal Beak charges at him and he holds up a long stick, a long branch, and it goes right into Metal Beak's gut. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what young Leonidas did to the wolf. And there's no way that wasn't intentional.
Well, that's what Prince Eric did to Ursula in The Little Mermaid, too.
Really? Really? So now you're saying Snyder's influenced by The Little Mermaid? That everything is a reference back to that?
I gotta represent Disney. I'm sorry. I'm just saying. Ursula, that was a badass way to go out.
There's a little difference, though, in the way it was done. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, similar, but... This where their backs are up against a rock and they're sort of crouched down in that similar position and that dark enemy goes on top of them almost. Yeah.
Can we talk about the fact that one of the things I liked, and I know this is going to sound kind of twisted, but I like the fact that he actually kills Metal Beak. Like you see a lot of these cartoons and what happens? He falls over a cliff. He falls into a cliff. He falls over a cliff. Like, the bad guy always falls to his death to keep the hands clean of the protagonist. And I kind of like the idea that the protagonist in this one actually killed the bad guy.
Well, so to make another reference, are you saying it's a little bit like Man of Steel?
Yeah. I like the fact that in Man of Steel, Superman actually kills the bad guy.
All right, hold on to that thought, because that's a big discussion point when we get to that entry in the Snyder series.
Yeah, I think we just lost about a quarter of our audience.
That's,
right.
Yeah.
But I think it's interesting that I didn't even put that together until I said it right then, Elliot. I think you're onto a new, really interesting point. The fact that Snyder will show his heroes doing what they have to do. Even in Dawn of the Dead, you know, the guy, quote unquote, seems to sacrifice himself at the end, but wasn't he just accepting reality and doing what he had to do? So Snyder doesn't see it as his protagonist getting their hands dirty. He just sees it as them accepting reality and doing what they have to do. There was no remorse on Soren's part for killing Metal Beak. It was just Metal Beak was attacking him, so he had to defend himself and stop
isn't
evil.
Isn't that exactly what the old wise owl tells him at the end? Doesn't he say almost exactly, what you had to do?
You did what you had to do. And even that speech that comes before that, when he says, you know, fighting a war, I mean, it's not heroic, it's not brave, it's not all that, it's just... doing the right thing. You have to do the right thing. And you're not always going to be a hero for doing the right thing.
You just made this movie a lot more valuable in Zack Snyder's catalog. Because anyone who ever wants to understand the ending of Man of Steel and the next snap just needs to watch that scene and watch this movie.
I'm going to give you an even crazier possible reference going on here.
Uh-oh.
With no proof whatsoever. It is wild speculation. Which is...
That's what we love to do here in the Midside. We just wildly speculate.
Which is the comic, the old comic, The Question, written by Steve Ditko, who was a well-known objectivist and creator of Spider-Man and several other really famous characters. In the premiere issue of The Question, he has... his hero kill the bad guy because that's what had to be done. And I think he said that exactly in an interview, but it was so controversial that the company he was working for, maybe it was Marvel at the time, I don't remember, said you can't have him kill him. Like it just, you can't do it. That's not what heroes should do. And so they made him draw it so that he kicks the guy in a river or in a sewer and he floats away. Or whatever. But that's why he left, ultimately. Because he said, that's ridiculous. Of course the heroes need to kill the bad guys. And remember that The Question is the basis for the character Rorschach.
I thought Mr. A was the basis for Rorschach.
No, The Question.
Okay.
Yeah.
So...
Because The Question is the one with the mask.
Okay, so... Your grand conspiracy theory is that Snyder is actually well aware of this comic history, is what you're saying? You're saying because you're aware of it, and he's a big-time director who obviously is very educated, he must be aware of it as well. That's your logical premise you're using, correct?
Yes, yes. And because Steve Ditko was a quasi-objectivist, and so is Snyder. Because of Snyder's own admission, by the way.
Because of his Ayn Rand aesthetic, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, this is my question then. Do you think that this is something he's aware of, or do you think it's just because he's Frank Miller adjacent, he's a friend of Frank, literally he's a friend of Frank, Do you think it's because that he just happens to have the same premises and comes to the same logical conclusions because he's a smart person, and that's why there's this parallel, or do you really think that he's aware of it?
I mean, I think it's both, right? So I think he's definitely aware of it. He is a student of the genre. And so I think he has to know about it, but I think he agrees with it is the other element of it. So.
Okay. So I think that's a good button to put on the Snyder style, discussion we're having for this movie. Let's move on to one final thing I want to discuss that I think is going to be close to your heart, Daniel. So this is the second time I watched the movie, and I realized something right now. I realized something while watching it. And it comes from what we know about one of Snyder's biggest early influence, as most young filmmakers growing up in that era. He's very influenced by Star Wars. So this is my question. Is this movie just Star Wars?
Use the Force, Luke.
Right. So
Trust your gizzard.
Right. That's the first thing. Trust your gizzard. Right. And then aren't the Guardians just Jedi? And nobody believes the Jedi exist anymore. And then the dark side is rising up in Metalbeak, who's a villain who wears a mask. And are you telling me that that army that the Pure Ones created didn't look like stormtroopers?
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty close. I think there's a lot of influence here. I think the trinkets are a very interesting kind of weapon, like a super weapon.
And, like a Death Star, maybe?
Yeah, and the hero has to like fly in at a really steep angle with basically a missile with like one shot.
And everyone tells him he can't do it because it'll kill him, but he does it anyway and it destroys everything, and that's what makes it so the good guys can beat the bad guys.
And he does it by trusting his gizzard.
I don't know, I saw a lot of, like religious things. I know you guys don't agree, but in terms of like...
Well, I agree. I think Star Wars is religious based. I think the Force is a metaphor for faith.
George Lucas cleared that up in the prequels. It's not religious, it's metachlorians.
I'm talking...
Because those aren't faith.
No, what I mean is, I think that instead of Star Wars, I think it's a little bit more like a hybrid of the Cain and Abel story from the Bible, or the Moses and the Pharisee, you know, I think that it's... Not Pharisee, but the Moses and the emperor of Egypt, you know, I think that's more or less, you know, the idea of Moses turning against his brother. His brother wants, you know, they were raised together, they were friends, and they turn against each other, and the brother wants to kill them, and he's trying to set free his people. That was more along what I was thinking. I thought it was a little bit kind of biblical in a way.
Well, I think it's very biblical as well. I definitely agree with everything you just said. I think the Cain and Abel comparison is very, very well taken. But I do think it's very Star Wars as well. I mean, I'm sort of joking when I say that, but I do think that you can't ignore the comparisons.
No, I definitely think you can, except that he doesn't have sex with his sister.
I hope not, because she's very underage.
Eggleteen! Yeah.
But is your argument for the gizzard, Daniel, the same argument you make for the Force?
Yes, basically. I mean, they... So I have a weaker argument for the Force than I do for the gizzard, I think, which is really sad. Because in Star Wars, they actually talk about, like Han Solo says, ancient religion in the movie. And so it's in there.
But isn't that because he's a Sawyer character and he's just being dismissive of it? So you can't take that as an actual characterization of the Force. That's just his dismissive characterization of it.
Yeah.
See, I can argue like a Star Wars fan too.
I'm not even that hardcore. I do think Lucas meant it as a quasi kind of religious thing at first, and then he became a radical liberal idiot. But my argument is basically the same, which is that the Force is something that in that universe, anyone who is attuned to it can speak to and use as a tool. And it's just some people are more talented, more naturally attuned than others. It's not mystical in a certain sense, because it is a part of the universe. It's not outside of the universe. It's not supernatural. It is just a piece of nature that we don't have in our reality.
Right, I agree, but that goes to Elliot's argument about this movie and why I'm right in the middle between you two, is it says something when a story writer, when a writer creates a narrative where something is normal would be something mystical in our society, in our world. That's their reflection of, that's their selection of reality. So they concretize it to try and make a point about it.
Yeah, it's just where do you draw the line? Right.
Right.
Like, the owls in this movie talk. Well, our owls in reality don't talk.
Right.
So is that already mystical? No, we take that as just part of the premise of the world. So in this world, owls can talk.
Right. Well, that's where it gets tricky, and you have to distinguish between style and content. And, you know, I'm not saying there should be a line. It should be perfectly integrated. But the best writers, the best directors, the best creators will make it clear which are supposed to be accurate reflections of reality and which aren't. That's one of the things about, you know, to kind of bring this back to Snyder and loop it back. That's one of the things that a lot of people who critique Snyder don't understand. You know, we'll get to this again. This is more Man of Steel foreshadowing. But one of the things at the end, people are like, Superman killed all the people in the buildings because he just threw Zod against the buildings. But they're not distinguishing, but that's not supposed to be taken literally. Snyder said that it's a fight between gods. I wanted to portray it that way. So there's no distinguishing between style and content there. Everything is taken literally or naturalistically.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm just saying that I don't take, I mean, I take as a given that these things exist in this world, if even if they don't exist in ours. And I don't, in order for me to see a spiritual or supernatural thing in a movie like that, it has to be presented in that way, supernatural, outside of the self, outside of the nature of that movie. But I don't think the gizzard in this instance or the force in the instance of Star Wars is portrayed that way.
All right, fair enough. Let's put a cap on this episode. Let's rate the movie and then let's rank the movie. So let's start by rating it. We remember we have our three rating system. The first is, you know, if it's bad, we rate it this. If it's all right, we rate it this.
Yeah, I think I'll just stay here a while. Enjoy the sunrise.
And if it's great, we rate it this.
This is blasphemy. This is madness.
Madness.
This is Sparta!
So each of you go ahead and we'll start with Elliot. How would you rate this movie? Give a little bit of a analysis, Elliot, and then what you would rate it.
I think that it's a very fun movie to watch. But I think that overall, the lack of integration of a lot of its themes really just kind of leaves me a little confused. So I would probably rate it.
Yeah, I think I'll just stay here a while. Enjoy the sunrise.
I'm probably going to be an even little more critical about this. I think the confusion in this movie serves to make it almost entirely unenjoyable for an adult. I think that there are elements of this that kids would like, and there were specific scenes where I thought were cool, and I thought some of the directing was good, but as a movie, as an integrated product, I think it's probably my least favorite Zack Snyder movie.
That's the rank it section. You're just rating it right now.
I know. I'm giving a little foreshadowing.
Spoilers.
But it's but that's part
Why
of my
Why is someone
going
to listen
to
the next 30 seconds now?
I know. Terrible. There'll be boobies at the end. Just kidding. There'll be no boobies. So I think I would rank it.
Wow. Now I feel like I'm the definitive voice here as to whether it's, you know, really bad or just all right. I'm surprised, Daniel, at how harsh you were. I mean, I think I agree with a lot of your critiques. I think as an adult, it was a little, it dragged for me because the confusion and sort of the lack of depth for it. The couple times I found it dragging were after Sauron escapes the Pure Ones, and then he's on the quest to find the Guardians where they live. I found that very boring. There was not any depth to it. It was just like, we're on a road movie now. And he had these two quirky sidekicks, which don't really ever serve a purpose later on in the movie. So that part kind of bored me. And then the final fight scene was kind of boring to me. It was kind of long, and besides like the shots of Snyder, the typical Snyder shots, I didn't really find myself interested all that much. So again, I'm right in between you two. Like, I don't know, like, do I want to rank it all the way, like rate it all the way down there to where you did, Daniel? Or do I want to do it as average as what Elliot said? And here's the thing. Overall, I agree. As an integrated whole, It's just not there. But I think if I look at it from a stylistic standpoint and what Snyder was able to achieve with it, I have to rate it.
Yeah. I think I'll just stay here a while. Enjoy the sunrise.
Yeah, I guess I'm particularly hard on it because it's an animated film. I mean, a lot of Snyder's work incorporate animation seamlessly with real life, and that's very cool stylistically in the way he does that. But this is a wholly animated film. I just think compared to this, to what we can achieve with animated films now, especially in terms of story, not just in terms of look. The look gets an A, the story gets pretty close to an F. So, I can't do it. There's so much better stuff out there.
Yeah, and sorry, no, I agree. I agree with
sorry, Zach. I still love you.
I agree with both of you is the thing. I see both of your arguments. I mean, this is no Lego movie and this is no Rise of the Guardians. This is no Shrek, right? Those are sort of like probably my three of my favorite animated movies. You know, it's not Aladdin. It's not any of those animated movies.
Yeah.
It's not anywhere close to any of those animated movies. So I think we've kind of all spoiled right now where we're going to rank it. So Elliot, where would you rank this movie among all of the other Zack Snyder movies we watched so far? Remember, we've already watched Dawn of the Dead, we've already watched Watchmen, we've already watched 300, and we've already covered all of those. So where would you rank the Owl movie, as we call it, behind the scenes? Where would you rank that in comparison to the other Snyder movies?
I'd probably put it under Dawn of the Dead. So it would be like, the bottom would be this movie, then Dawn of the Dead. Did you just throw something?
No.
Did I make you angry?
No, it fell.
Justin mad.
Smash. No, it would probably be like, it would be like this movie, Dawn of the Dead would be better, and then Watchmen would be better, and then 300 would be better than that.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I agree. This is my least favorite Zack Snyder movie by far. So definitely this at the bottom, Dawn of the Dead, Watchmen 300.
Yeah, I would rank it exactly the same way. I think that this movie has more Snyder style than Dawn of the Dead had, because Dawn of the Dead was sort of his directorial debut, and I don't think he was as defined as he was when he made this movie. But I think Dawn of the Dead benefited from working with a writer who, of course, has since gone on to write and direct Guardians of the Galaxy. So I think that really helped Snyder, whereas here I think Snyder was really hindered by the source material and the people who adapted this movie, which makes it so this is the only Snyder movie I would never rewatch. I only rewatched this for this podcast, and I don't think I'll ever rewatch it again for the rest of my life. Maybe if I have kids one day I might show it to them, but again, I'd rather show them the Lego movie, Rise of the Guardians, Shrek, Aladdin, you know,
Finding Nemo.
Yes, Finding Nemo. I was going to say Frozen. Is Frozen better than this movie?
These are about on par. On par.
This movie makes me think of, like, if Tom Brady was traded to the Browns for a season.
How about like, if Tom Brady was on the Jets? Or recently on NFL.com, they said in the 2000 redraft, the Browns would have taken Tom Brady. So this movie is like, if that draft had happened that way and Tom Brady had gone to the Browns and spent his career there.
Yeah, just like you take this immense talent and then give him like this literal giant pile of brown and say, make something out of this.
This pellet,
yes. And you say, pick the fleck out of this pellet and trust your gizzard. Can you imagine if somebody says...
Yes, that's like the metaphor. That is the metaphor. Pick the metal, like the gold shiny metal out of this huge pellet that we coughed up for you.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Snyder series, you will definitely enjoy the other episodes more. One of our reviews on iTunes, which is very awesome, was very glowing towards our Watchmen edition, which is I think definitely is our best edition so far because there's the most to talk about in that movie. So if you enjoyed this, go back and check out our other episodes, our other editions of the Snyder series.
Daniel? Yeah, that would be at themidside.com/podcast. You can search for Zack Snyder or Snyder Series. You'll find them there. As Justin mentioned, we've covered Dawn of the Dead, 300, Watchmen, and now the Owl movie.
And next, I'm so excited. You know what's next?
Sucker Punch, right?
The Eyelash movie is next. I'm so excited.
This is the one movie that Zack Snyder wrote, correct?
Yes, he wrote, he co-wrote it and he directed it. And I'm so excited to discuss it. It's one of my favorite movies and it's so unfairly maligned.
I just can't wait to see the hate mail we get for giving this movie.
Oh, the deleted
review.
John Hamm scene is so good.
You sent it to me and I love that scene and they should have kept it in because it nails the theme so perfectly. You know, and it
literally nails
victory.
It does. It literally nails the theme and it literally nails Baby Doll, right?
But literally nails Baby Doll. But it also it shows her victory in the end. Like why she's victorious even though she's, you know, well, you'll just have to watch it and find out.
So if you want to hear our review of Sucker Punch and want to get it the second it comes out, you should definitely subscribe to us on iTunes.
And hear why Sucker Punch is actually awesome.
And like us on Facebook at facebook.com/TheMidside. And of course, if you leave us a review on iTunes, that means even more people will get to hear our awesome takes on various things. And they will think you are awesome for recommending this sweet-ass podcast.
I'm Justin M. Lesneski, and I hope you enjoyed this edition of the Snyder Series. This concludes your journey into The Midside. Good luck out there, and remember, if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day.
What happened to Hail Snyder?
No, wait, Elliot.
No, I said have a day. You say Hail Snyder, Daniel.
No. You said, I said no.
Oh, you said no?
I said no.